This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on this episode, Elliot Ackerman, the best-selling author and former US military serviceman, discusses his latest book, 2054, a novel that depicts a dystopian future and a world of super intelligent AI influencing conflict and geopolitics that feels eerily within sight. Elliot is a former US Marine, and his co-author, Admiral Jim Stavridis, spent more than 30 years in the US Navy. Joining Elliot to discuss the book is Carl Miller, co-founder of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. He's author of The Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab. Let's join Carl now with more.
I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, Elliot Ackerman. He's the author of actually a ton of books, including Dark at the Crossing, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. And his writings have appeared in lots of places as well. Esquire, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, among other publications. And his stories have been included in the Best American Short Stories. He's a former White House fellow and Marine and served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor and the Purple Heart. And his latest book, which we'll be discussing now, is 2054. A novel co-written with Admiral James Stavridis. Elliot, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
So before we jump into the novel itself, Elliot, give us a bit of the backstory. So there's been a terrible nuclear war between the US and China. When did that happen? Why? And what kind of society do we find ourselves in as we step into 2054?
Well, this novel is the second part of a planned trilogy, and the first part of that trilogy is the novel 2034. And in that book, we see the United States and China enter an escalatory crisis that culminates in an exchange of nuclear weapons. And on the backside of 2034, both China and the United States are really in tatters, and we're left with India as a real rising power. So we then go 20 years into the future. And in 2054, when the novel opens, what we see is increasing trends of polarization and partisanship in the United States that has led to the emergence of 2 new political parties, one a majority party and one a minority party. And the leader of the majority party, the president, refusing to let go of power, at the same time that new, really conscious-altering technologies are coming onto the scene. And one of those technologies seems to be implicated in the death of this president, which occurs in the first chapter. And that sends American society tumbling into a crisis that brings it really up to the brink of civil war.
Oh, yes, the truthers and the dreamers. Well, sure. Elliot, we'll get onto that in a second, But beforehand, give us a sense of this society. It seems to be one that's kind of both racing towards a singularity and also one that's ripping itself apart.
Well, I think that in many ways, you know, mirrors our society right now.
Right.
In which the pace of technological advancement and change is as high as it's probably been in the course of human history, where remarkable new technologies are coming onto the scene, it seems almost weekly, that promise to fundamentally alter the way we work, the way we create, the way we live, you know, human life, also at a time when it seems as though humanity and civilization is also sort of in this race to the bottom, as we see rises in bigotry and authoritarianism And so we're sort of tearing ourselves apart at the same time as we're building ourselves up. And so the duality, that duality of creation and destruction, is definitely a theme in 2054, and it's very much in the air at the outset of that novel, you know, when the president basically dies, and there's a lot of questions of whether or not he's died of natural causes, whether or not he's been assassinated, and if he has been assassinated, who or even what is responsible for that assassination.
And the president, Castro, who you said dies early in the novel, is, I think, on his fifth term, is that right? You know, I mean, is that budding authoritarianism also something that you're kind of, I guess, extrapolating from the kind of current politics that we see in America into something which is going to kind of consolidate and potentially get worse in the decades ahead?
I think it's a theme that we just don't only see in America. I think it's a theme that we see through the course of human history, which is that if there's one thing that you can sort of count on in our human story, it's that people who have vast amounts of power are extremely reluctant to ever give up that power voluntarily, and they will cling to it to their very last breath. And really, the instances in history where people do voluntarily relinquish power are by far the exception as opposed to a rule. And so that becomes a theme in the book. And this President Castro has been a very effective president. And after the calamitous events of 2034, he's really the single individual who is responsible for pulling the United States back from the brink and seeing the United States, maybe not to restore to its, you know, to its epoch, but restore to a functioning country. However, the caveat is he then believes he's the only one who can keep the United States from the brink, and as such is reluctant to give up power.
And we do see a United States in 2054, certainly by no means the global superpower anymore, but one of a series of players in a kind of much, it seems, more crowded like geopolitical landscape. Tell us about some of these other actors. You've got the kind of Nigerians, the Indians, you know, there seems to be all kinds of both state and non-state actor, in fact, that have become increasingly important.
Well, I think that is an extrapolation of current trends, and that the world is today becoming much more multipolar than it was in the second half of the 20th century. You know, it's often been said that demographics are destiny, and American demographics and European demographics are declining in ways that demographics in countries like India, Nigeria, Brazil, you have much stronger and younger populations. And so by the year 2054, extrapolating out, we see that those are really the countries that that are coming onto the fore on the world stage. But the nature of global competition has also changed. Whereas in the past, global power was defined in military terms, you know, as well as economic terms, what we're seeing is that global power becomes defined in technological terms. Who are the technological superpowers, the countries that are at the very, very forefront of innovation? Because those are the countries that are increasingly not only able to dominate economically, but are also starting to be able to dominate politically, but then also biologically as well.
The great game.
Yes.
As it's all been played for so many centuries,
yes.
now increasingly one of control over this technology emerging into the singularity.
And we're already seeing the antecedents of that right now. Whereas if, for instance, the great competition and power competition of the 20th century was centered around nuclear arms and a nuclear arms race and then a technological space race, I think, you know, what we're seeing right now, particularly vis-a-vis the United States and China, is a race around artificial intelligence and who can outpace the other in machine learning and a capacity to innovate in that sphere, because whoever dominates in the AI space is going to have significant economic dominance and probably military dominance. And so that also becomes one of the themes in the book, as we see these types of technological arms races between nations. And those races also have a significant part of them that rely on the private sector as well.
Elliot, tell us a bit about the role of protest in the book, because you've got these kind of brigades, I think, as you describe them, and they kind of come across as, I mean, they're firstly, like, very important, aren't they, to the way the plot actually develops? But they're increasingly come across as like paramilitary mobilizations, really, that have the kind of power to shut down DC, and are a constant presence around the White House in the in the kind of like over the duration of the story. Is this something that, you know, I imagine you must have actually seen this in a way happening around you, you know, living in DC and seeing, you know, what's happened over Trump's tenure and onwards?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's definitely something that is a presence in American life, which are, you know, you could call them, you know, militias or protest movements. You know, we've saw it with right-wing groups like the Proud Boys or far-left groups like Antifa. And these groups frequently represent the militarized fringe wings of the two political movements in the United States. And often, not only in the United States, but if you look back in history in other countries, there is sort of a tacit agreement between the respectable political entities and the more fringe wings of their party to work in concert. And so you very much see that, you know, America in 2054 still is a bipolar political entity. There's sort of two major groups, but their extreme wings are warring with one another and taking their grievances out into the streets in ways that wind up ensnaring the U.S. military as well.
Well, those two groups, the Truthers and the Dreamers, tell us a bit about those, because they seem defined far less by the normal cleavages of U.S. politics and much more by this kind of new bundle of identities.
I think, you know, one of the trends that is often not reported on in the United States, but I think is really significant, is that the U.S. is a country in which the majority of Americans don't identify with either the Democratic or the Republican Party. So our two majority parties are actually two minority parties. And that's today. And so taking those trends and extrapolating them out, you know, we imagine that in 2054, you will have seen the Democratic and Republican parties continue to shed membership to the point where they're really two rump parties. Both increasingly extreme, both increasingly fringe. And in order to survive, they have to band together and they become the Democratic Republican Party, which was actually in the early 19th century, a political party in the United States. And these types of alliances in American politics are really not without precedent because, you know, unlike the parliamentary system where you can have sort of small parties, the American system just lends itself to two major parties, and that often will create really strange alliances. Like, for instance, in the mid-20th century, when you had in the Democratic Party Northeastern liberals coexisting with Southern segregationists. I mean, that was the Democratic Party in the 1940s and 50s. So the Democratic Republicans form into their own party, and they are colloquially known as the Truthers. Because, you know, they believe that their rigid version of truth is the one truth. And then this very charismatic figure after the war in 2034 emerges. And this is an immigrant. His name is Angel Castro. He likes to quip that if this country could elect a president with the middle name Hussein, they could certainly elect a president with the last name Castro. And he emerges initially as an independent political figure, runs for president and wins, but then inevitably a party coalesces around him and they become the American Dream Party. But he is certainly their figurehead. And so by the year 2054, the great tension that exists in American life is one between the Democratic Republicans and Castro, or put differently, between the Truthers on one side and the Dreamers on the other.
And we've already mentioned it a little bit, but let's focus on the singularity. Because that seems to be the kind of quite a covert secret race, doesn't it? A kind of race that most members of American society probably aren't aware in 2054 is happening. You know, a race of kind of intelligence agencies and tech companies and the military and a series of protagonists. Tell us what the singularity represents in the book, this kind of melding together of kind of biological, kind of gene, remote gene editing and quantum computing.
Yeah, it's really this idea, and we're already seeing the antecedents of it today, that, you know, potentially in 30 years, we would have the ability with the power of quantum computing and advances in biology to basically upload our consciousness to a computer chip. so that your personality, your memories would be able to exist beyond the realm of your lifetime. And that we will also start to see really this line that is, you know, at least right now in our country, it's a pretty hard line between technology and biology, become increasingly porous. And again, these are things that we've already seen the antecedents of. For instance, when we went through the pandemic, millions of us injected a technology into our body that was not a strictly biological technology, and that were these vaccines. And so we will start to get to the point in our evolution as human beings where the technologies we're using to alter our body will become so prevalent and will also become so small that the difference between molecules and microchips will become increasingly less meaningful. And so in the book, both China, Nigeria, all these powers are racing towards the singularity, which is the moment in which we are able to harness the power of quantum computing to vastly accelerate human intelligence. That becomes a contest between nations that's every bit as profound as the contest we saw, for instance, between the United States and the Soviet Union in the 20th century to become the nuclear dominant nation. So I think what's a little bit different though is, you know, the beginning of that arms race, we all had a very clear visual representation of what nuclear power meant. And that was the dropping of the A-bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, we're standing right now, I think today, you know, on a similar, you know, and at the dawn of a similarly profound age of human innovation. Just what's more challenging is there isn't that visual representation like we had in 1945, even though the pace of change is every bit as quick and every bit as profound.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And despite the enormous potential that reaching the singularity might have for human health and well-being, it's also something which you see as fundamentally annihilatory.
Well, it's this dance, you know, like one of the characters in the book, a guy named Sandy Chowdhury, who's in the first book as well. When we meet him in the first book, he's a young White House staffer. He's an American, but of Indian descent. When we meet him in the second book, he is sort of toward the end of his life and has become sort of a great titan of private equity and finance. And he's funding some of these efforts. And his group, that his investment vehicle is called the Tandava Group. Which is Hinduism is sort of the dance and the interplay between the creation and destruction, and that the two always exist hand in hand. And, you know, and that's something that really cuts across cultures. Like, for instance, if we look at the Greek myths and the legend of, you know, Pandora and her box, you know, when Pandora opens her box, you know, all the suffering and destruction of humanity comes pouring out of this box in very, very destructive ways. But if you remember, the end of that myth is the very last thing that's left in the box after all of this destruction pours out is this little kernel. And this last little kernel is actually hope. So hope is the one thing left in the box. So I think creation and destruction always exist in tandem. And 2054 is a book that is about both.
Well, whilst we're on characters, there's another one that, Elliot, I'd like you to talk about. So there's a very kind of tired centrist admiral, isn't there, that seems like basically to be at times the only adult in the whole administration that's trying to resist the kind of the pulls of bipartisan rancor in one direction or another. Now, I couldn't help but notice, of course, that your co-author is a retired admiral and that you're both of course, military veterans. So I just wondered whether there are echoes of the way that you both feel in that character and the importance of someone like that in a US administration that's going to be beset by these kinds of challenges.
You know, one of the things that, I've written a number of novels and people, when they ask about the characters in the past, you know, the ones that I write on my own, I always have to admit, you know, well, these characters, like, they're all sort of me, they're versions of me. I'm trying on. The thing that's been fun of writing this book is actually the characters are all both of us. And so they're sort of versions of both of us. And so Admiral John Bunt Hendrickson is a character who was also, he was also in the first book. And when you meet him now, he is a retired admiral working as the White House chief of staff at the beginning of the book. And he becomes sort of the one adult in the room, trying to hold everything together, but also very cognizant of the horrible role that the military is placed into when the partisans on either side of American political life insist on pushing society to the brink. Because if when you push and you push and you push and the crises become ever more extreme, you eventually force onto military members a choice as to, you know, which side they're going to throw themselves behind. And in the book, it builds towards that. And it's not a choice where the US military goes with all with one side or all with the other. The military itself cleaves because, you know, as much as the American military is an apolitical force, it doesn't mean the military members don't have political beliefs. There's just a culture of omerta. But that culture can break. And so Bunt becomes kind of a moral center in the book, trying to keep that break from happening, but also, I think, giving the reader a sense of what that break means potentially.
Does that reflect a kind of sense you have of the military and maybe the national security community more generally being squeezed in this world of bipartisan rancor, you know, that increasingly being pulled into US politics in a way that it's resisted and desperately tried to avoid for so long?
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about US politics today, you know, and even in the past, and then we extrapolate out, what becomes sort of clear is that when we find ourselves in these, you know, hyper-partisan moments, you're really in a situation when there's a tyranny of the minority over the majority. Meaning, you know, most Americans are not these insane partisans that we see out on the fringe of the right or the left. Most Americans sort of want to just, you know, go about their lives and have sort of common sense solutions to the problems facing us. However, we have political systems, media systems that are all sort of incited to trying to generate rage, because rage activates voters, it activates viewers, and many of us are just sort of stuck in the middle. I think the thing that's different in the national security state is, even though that same dynamic exists, you know, the national security state has got its hands on some very, very important levers of power. And so both sides are often trying to force their hands to come to their aid. And I think when we see crises occur in politics, you know, whether it's around, you know, what happened in the US in 2020, or, you know, concerns about the election that's coming up, eventually it doesn't take much to imagine those crises playing out and realizing that the national security state is going to get drug into this thing one way or another. And that becomes very, very concerning and very, very dangerous.
Does another character, Major Julia Hunt, does she kind of represent that American that's in the middle? It seems that she's like desperately trying to forge an honorable moral path through the story, and yet the swirling events around her continually put her in positions which are completely impossible.
That's right. So, I mean, Julia Hunt is another character. She's the adopted daughter of one of the characters who was very central in the first book, Sarah Hunt, who was the admiral in 2034, who is responsible for launching a couple of the U.S.'s nuclear strikes. And so her adopted daughter finds herself also serving in uniform as a Marine, first at the White House and then eventually at the Marine Barracks in Washington, D.C. And so when the political crisis starts to sweep into Washington, she finds herself in command of a garrison of about 1,000 Marines. And the question foisted on her is, you know, who are you going to support, the truthers or the dreamers? Because both of them are asking for the Marines to come out and lend them a hand. And I think for, without spoiling too much of the novel, but for Julia, her decision becomes much less ideological as to who she thinks is in the right on both sides. She sort of, you know, comes to a conclusion of, you know, a pox on both your houses, but winds up making a decision that is the one that will allow the majority of her Marines to basically, and she says it's just to go home, to get back to their homes so they can kind of have a life once this crisis breezes over. And I think you know, the tacit statement there is that in any conflict, and I've seen this having fought in wars and then covered wars as a journalist, is that the immediate exigencies of just keeping yourself safe, keeping your family safe, often, well, in almost all cases, take much greater priority than any type of abstract ideology.
Well, there's one more character, Elliot, I'd like you to introduce us to, and that is the great, real person, the great futurist and technologist Ray Kurzweil. So tell us a bit about the role that he has in the story.
Well, when we were, you know, as I mentioned, this is the second book in a trilogy, and this project really is dealing with what we view as sort of the three great challenges that will probably face humanity in the 21st century. One is, you know, a peer-on-peer conflict, and we do it with China. This book is about civil conflict and the rise of artificial intelligence. And the last book is going to be 2084, will be about the environment. But that being said, as we were, you know, talking about this book and the ideas in this book very early on, we had both read and were rereading at this point a book that came out 20 years ago by Ray Kurzweil called The Singularity Is Near, in which many of the ideas that we're talking about right now, and in many ways our reality, was sort of prophesized in this book that he wrote 20 years ago. So the more Jim and I were sort of talking about the book and the ideas in the book, and we sort of realized we were going to be referencing Kurzweil in the novel, then I think at a certain point we just realized, you know, I think we should just become a character in the novel. And so he is sort of, he's mostly off stage, but there's this sort of search for Kurzweil that becomes one of the narrative strands of the book. You know, who is he? What did he mean? And what is the role that he has had in achieving the singularity? And one of the things we played with as well, which, you know, we hope he likes, is that given advances in technology, we also imagine that he is alive and healthy in the year 2054, which I think puts him at about age 120.
Well, it feels like the moment we're in, I don't know what you think, Elliot, but it feels like the moment that we're in is one where maybe thanks to AI and the vast uncertainties which technology is kind of throwing out into the world, we are trying to peer into the future perhaps more ardently than we used to, but that future is also more mysterious than it used to be. What do you think the role of fictional writing is there? Because it seems that you and your co-author can do something which, you know, as like a departure of fantasy and imagination, which most kind of futurist thinking can't do. And that seems to me, at least, to be very, very precious and important.
You know, these books are not works of prediction. They're works of speculation. I mean, this is speculative fiction. And the spirit behind it is, you know, if we can imagine some of these outcomes, which are not positive, right? A war with China, devastating civil conflict in the US, that by imagining them, that is really one of the first steps we can take to avoiding them. And so that's been the spirit with which we've been writing these books, is trying to, you know, see some of the wrong turns that we could take. And by marking them off very, very clearly, you know, perhaps we'll be able to just sort of drive right past them. And never go down those paths. So I think both of us, as much as we're, you know, writing books that, you know, we think are fun and are page turners, but are about fairly grim topics, you know, are ultimately optimistic that, you know, our best days are ahead of us, that these are crises that we will be able to avoid, that we do not have to fight a war with China, that the United States doesn't have to tear itself apart, and that these new technologies don't have to spell the downfall of all humanity. But we are imagining situations in which some of that comes to pass, so that other people, you know, can imagine a way past those hazards as well.
And in the face of all that, what are the things that make you feel more optimistic? I mean, is it the human capacity for adaptation? Is it the resilience of societies? Basic long-standing constitutional principles of U.S. democracy? Like, what do we have to make us feel like we can get over those challenges? Because as you say, lots of the trends that you're drawing into 2054 are quite bleak. You know, techno-enabled authoritarianism, but much weaker society, and a nuclear exchange.
I think the thing that I feel the most optimistic about is that our institutions typically are very resilient, even though they can be put under extremely uncomfortable situations where there's a lot of stress. And I think ultimately, you know, people want to pause. They don't want to go down these paths. They want to, you know, live secure, safe, happy lives. And so I think, you know, we are often the ones who bring ourselves back from our worst impulses. Although we have in the past let it get pretty bad before we, you know, are able to kind of snatch the reins. So that is ultimately, it's just sort of the individual who leaves me feeling optimistic. That when you take each of the characters in the book, you know, they are ultimately the ones who rescue the narrative. And these narratives are drawn, you know, not by huge, completely insurmountable forces. They're drawn up by individuals. And you'll see each of the books, the way they're told, is sort of through a soda straw perspective. Because, you know, as we often say, Jim and I, you know, big doors swing on small hinges, and it's sort of the small hinges that give me hope.
Well, when can we expect, is it 2084, did you say?
2084, yes. We're working hard at it. I think probably year after next, we'll have it out there.
Great. Well, Elliot, thank you. This has been fascinating. The book, which really is a page-turner, is 2054, a novel, and is available from your local bookshop. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Carmilla, and you have been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by myself, Connor Boyle, and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.